The headlines this hour: Palestinian resistance forces fire some 100 rockets at Israeli targets. Retaliation for the recent Israeli aggression that's claimed scores of Palestinian lives so far. Top diplomats from Iran, Syria, Russia, and Turkey are meeting in Moscow to discuss Syria-related issues. And Pakistan's former premier Imran Khan is remanded in custody for 8 days, while nationwide protests demanding his release continue for a second day. It's 5:30 p.m. in Iran's capital, Tehran. This is news. It's good to have you with us. Israel continues to rain down bombs on the Gaza Strip for the second day in a row. Smoke billowed from the besieged Palestinian territory as Israel hit targets. The regime says it struck rockets launching infrastructure held by the Islamic Jihad resistance movement. Palestinian health officials say several Gazans have been killed and a number of others, including a child, wounded in the fresh Israeli raids. The regime launched its strikes on the Gaza Strip on Tuesday. Since then, 19 Palestinians have been killed, including 3 senior members of the Islamic Jihad. Palestinian resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip have hit back at Israel's aerial strikes in the besieged territory. Palestinians returned fire by launching rockets from Gaza City toward Israeli targets. The retaliatory attacks set off sirens in and around Tel Aviv and prompted residents to seek shelter. The Israeli military claims it has intercepted the rockets. Local media, however, report that a building was hit in the town of Sderot. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has vowed to respond to Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Prida on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of 3 high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzedine and Haja al-Bahdani, 2 Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of 3 senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Al Asi, Gaza.
Palestinians hold a funeral procession for two more people killed in a fresh Israeli attack in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces resorted to live fire on Palestinians during a raid on the city of Jenin. According to eyewitnesses, during the raid, Israeli snipers took positions on the rooftops, while others forcefully entered a number of homes and destroyed people's property. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of homes. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. The correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Palestinians are desperately waiting for the international community to take actions against Israel for its crimes.
Every day, Israeli forces raid Palestinian areas, arrest people, destroy their homes, confiscate their lands, and kill people in cold blood. Not all of these Palestinians that are being killed by the Israeli forces are Palestinian fighters or members of the resistance groups. Many of those who are murdered are civilians, children, women, elderly. But at the end of the day, the international community is only issuing statements of condemnation, not more than this, calling the Israeli forces to stop their illegal, or even they didn't describe the practices as illegal. They are only demanding the Israeli forces to stop measures of aggression against the Palestinians. So the Palestinians do not expect anything from the international community or even the United Nations or even the Arab states. What the Palestinians really want, not a statement of condemnation, they want a serious position from the world to force the Israeli regime to stop their crimes. But knowing at the end of the day, as long as the Israeli regime is backed by the American administration, then they would continue to act as a state above the law. They would continue to keep reminding the Palestinians that they are under occupation and that they don't have the right to fight till ending this Israeli occupation.
Iran's new ambassador to Syria has highlighted the importance of establishing a joint bank and eliminating the U.S. dollar from trade transactions between the two countries.
The establishment of a joint bank and the removal of the dollar from financial trades and also eliminating custom taxes and tariffs are two major issues. Also, the establishment of joint insurance companies will provide a ground for investment and economic growth in the two countries.
Akbari described the developments as positive steps toward enhancing cooperation between private sectors also. He says such opportunities will pave the way for the private sector to bring in capital and encourage investment. Tehran and Damascus have agreed to expand bilateral cooperation, particularly in the economy and trade, following a historic visit by President Ibrahim Raisi to the Arab country last week. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, has met with the Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq, in Muscat to discuss security cooperation between the two countries. During the meeting, the Omani ruler and the Iranian general also discussed regional issues. Sultan Haytham called for mutual defense collaboration and said that he would pay a visit to the Islamic Republic in the near future. General Baghari, for his part, stressed the importance of joint efforts by the two neighbors to boost regional security. He said the future world order would be based on multilateralism, adding that the global shift of power from the West to the Asia center is imminent. Baghari held talks with other Omani officials during his visit to the country that ended on Tuesday. In Tehran, the top Iranian general Mohammad Baghari on Wednesday addressed an international conference on the New World Order geometry. He said that Iran's Islamic revolution has been one of the pillars to fight the U.S. hegemonic agenda around the globe. The major general highlighted U.S. failures in several regional countries, including Afghanistan and Iraq, despite spending billions of dollars on its military adventurism. He said even Washington's traditional allies do not trust it anymore, adding that the U.S. has been left isolated more than ever. The top Iranian general also said that the U.S. power has diminished significantly over the past decades. The two-day conference has brought together thinkers, officials, and academics from some 37 countries. The topics such as new concepts and the formation of a new world order and its components will be discussed. A quadrilateral meeting among the foreign ministers of Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Russia is being held in Moscow. Officials are set to raise a series of issues, with a stated focus being on the current situation in Syria. Our correspondent Marina Kortunova joined us from the Russian capital to tell us what has been going on behind closed doors.
The talks are taking place in one of the halls of the reception house of the Russian Foreign Ministry on Spiridonovka. I'm in the press center at the moment. So it is expected that during the meeting, the foreign ministers will discuss issues on the return of Syrian refugees to their homeland, as well as the fight against terrorism. The Turkish authorities will raise the issue of the return of Syrian refugees. And now, as you know, the Syrian authorities are not able to provide conditions for the return of refugees from Turkey. Lavrov, Abdullahian, Mikdad and Çavuşoğlu meet in the light of attempts to normalize relations and eliminate contradictions between Damascus and Ankara, and the countries are participants in the Astana process to resolve the Syrian crisis. Also, as you know, in Moscow, in the end of April, talks were held between the defense ministers of the four countries. And the Syrian Minister of Defense then stated that the issue of the withdrawal of Turkish troops from the country's territory was discussed during the meeting. The Turkish Defense Ministry told that the parties discussed concrete steps for Moscow to normalize relations between Ankara and Damascus. If the subsequent results of the meeting are successful, a Turkish-Syrian summit should follow, but it is difficult to predict the results in advance, especially considering how long the parties have been going to this meeting in Moscow. In early April, technical consultations between the deputy foreign ministers of the four countries were held in the Russian capital as well, and they were also meant to produce the exact day and content of this ministerial meeting, which intends to facilitate the normalization of relations between Syria and Turkey. Yesterday, upon his arrival, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also expressed hope that the Moscow talks would create conditions for the return of Syrian refugees to their home country and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has received an invitation to attend next week's Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi King Salman has invited Assad to attend the summit as the body agreed to bring Syria back into its fold after years of suspension. Assad says the summit, set to be held in Jeddah, will enhance joint Arab action to achieve shared aspirations. The invitation was made one day after Riyadh and Damascus announced that they would reactivate their diplomatic missions. Riyadh cut its diplomatic ties with Damascus in the wake of the foreign-backed militancy in Syria in 2011. The rapprochement between Syria and Arab states come as the Syrian armed forces have managed to score victories against the foreign-backed militants. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been remanded in custody for 8 days by an anti-graft court. At least four people have been killed in Peshawar as Khan's supporters clashed with police across the country. Another person died on Tuesday. The violent protests erupted when Khan was detained from the High Court, where he had gone to seek bail in multiple cases. The arrest brought thousands of his supporters to the streets across the nation. Nearly 1,000 people were arrested in Punjab alone. The former cricketing superstar has denied all charges against him. He says that they are part of an effort by the struggling government to prevent him from returning to power. The drama follows months of a political crisis during which Khan, who was ousted in April of last year, waged an unprecedented campaign against the country's powerful military. The death toll has now reached 21, including 5 children and at least 52 injured from Israel's military aggression on Gaza. I believe that death toll has risen by 1 since the last time we ran it. So that death toll keeps increasing based on the aggression by the Israeli military. Keep your eye out for obviously developing, this is a developing story, so we'll bring you updates as we have been at the bottom of your screen. A new study shows half of the residents in the U.S. city of Chicago have been exposed to gun violence by the age of 40. The survey, published in the Journal of American Medical Association, was conducted on a sample of over 2,400 participants. The results showed the average participants were first exposed to gun violence by the age of 14. Also, 7% had been shot, while 50% had seen someone shot. The study also found that black people live in social contexts with far higher risk of seeing or becoming victims of firearm-related incidents. Also, a separate study suggested that young men in certain Chicago neighborhoods face a greater risk of dying from gun violence than U.S. military troops who served in Afghanistan or in Iraq. The European Parliament votes in favor of a 1 billion euro package to ramp up ammunition production in the EU to support Ukraine's war effort against Russia, That, as critics argue, the move is obscene at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
The EU's anti-Russia position is conveyed on huge posters surrounding the European Parliament. However, the move to isolate Moscow and its cheap energy is inflicting great hardship on millions of citizens throughout the bloc. EU legislators voted on Tuesday to support a €1 billion ammunition package for Ukraine.
The EU member states have to put their money where their mouth is.
But not all are in favour.
Not a war on poverty or homelessness or on climate change, but a diktat to the public of Europe that they have to accept another €1 billion being laundered from their pockets into the fat wallets of the global arms industry.
We have been gathering reactions from experts. So can the 27-country bloc afford this additional money, a huge amount, on top of the many billions that it's already sent to Ukraine?
They have no choice because they submitted to the US decision, because they no longer free to decide, because Western Europe is divided, Eastern Europe is totally submitted to the US.
Arms manufacturers in 11 EU nations will now be given huge grants to produce 1 million artillery shells for Ukraine during the coming 12 months.
The European Union received the Nobel Prize in 2012. Would it not be better to go for peace between Ukraine and Russia? Now the EU just wants to move towards escalation and being bogged down in war.
Security analysts are now pondering how the Kremlin might respond to the relentless attempts to apply pressure. Many lawmakers say EU sanctions against Russia are hurting citizens here far more than their intended target. Well, an 11th round of sanctions on Moscow will soon be unveiled by the bloc's leaders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Manhattan Federal Court has found the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, liable for sexually abusing magazine writer E. Jean Carroll in the 1990s. Jurors decided that Trump should reward his accuser $5 million in punitive damages. That includes compensation for defaming Carroll. She's argued that Trump's public denials wrecked her career. The former president says the court decision is, quote, a disgrace. Trump will appeal the verdict. He says the trial is evidence of a, quote, democratic plot to tarnish his political image. Carroll has said that she decided to break her silence in 2017 after rape allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein prompted scores of women to come forward with accounts of sexual violence by powerful men. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World Newscast. Bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Thank you.
Bazaar.
Wherever you go, you are surrounded by real estate, whether they are houses, offices, shops, hotels, or education, or even healthcare facilities. These buildings are all the products of Realty Development. Property is a multi-business. It can involve buying land and building on it, renovating or improving, or converting property from one use to another. All of which adds higher value to the area. Property developers quite literally build the world around us, creating and changing the environments we inhabit and use on our daily basis.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will take a look at Iran's housing and light construction industry. We want to uncover how this market is doing and what contributions it is making to living standards along with the economy. Time to light up today's Bazaar.
In order to become more familiar with the activities of light construction in Iran, we decided to visit a real estate developer in the capital city, Tehran. Nexa Group was established over a decade ago and is a known name in the construction industry. Essentially, it develops luxury properties for residential purposes. In a nutshell, a developer adds value to land or property. What sets this company apart from other developers is its choice of cream-of-the-crop architects who are highly creative, innovative, and experienced in the field of design. Clients who have land they wish to develop can seek the services of this contractor. This company then enters a contract with the owner and begins the process of vetting architects for designing its buildings. In recent years, several competitions have been held by this developer for residential projects. The winning design that meets the high standards of this company and its clients is awarded the project. But that's not all. This company also has a vast network of highly specialized subcontractors to take care of other aspects of construction, such as structure engineering, excavators, and so on. Among its many activities, this developer provides building management services. Such services include maintenance of plumbing, electrical, and mechanical installations of the building.
There are several different types of property development. Some are large scale, meaning that several lots of land are being developed into a single plot. These types of developments can be subdivided and sold individually or as a whole. There are also developments for commercial and sports uses, such as shopping centers and stadiums. Ooh, I like the sound of this.
Projects at this company range from low to medium density residential buildings. This developer also pays particular attention to designing buildings that are environmentally friendly. Most of its buildings are constructed following green practices that also elevate the living standards and quality of experience of its end users. One of its most recent residential projects is called Phoenix. What is most unique about this building is that it was designed based on the traditional 9-square method of Iranian architecture. This green building incorporates the needs of people during the coronavirus pandemic, which includes spaces for working from home. Large investments are made in real estate development each day. But adding value to the property, such as luxury structures with numerous amenities, are what really drive profits. And this company is ready to work with foreign investors and export its services along these lines. One of the competitive advantages of this developer, relative to others in the country, are its innovative and exceptional designs that gain the attention of clients and customers. Its luxury developments are geared to entice customers with more accommodations, higher-end options that integrate an entire lifestyle, and an elevated culture of living. The quality of its work has increased competition in the domestic market, making its buildings a must-have among customers. This property developer also has a unique view of the US-imposed sanctions, which has helped the company thrive throughout the years.
Iran has a growing population of around 85 million people, and the majority of the population is still young. But as time goes by, this population will age as they start families. With this in mind, many of them are embarking on the journey of purchasing homes. And for this to become possible, more housing units need to be constructed to meet this growing need.
The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development estimates that the per capita of housing for each Iranian is around 200 square meters. This means that 17 billion square meters of buildable land is needed to house every Iranian. According to the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development, the annual demand for homes stands at 900,000 units. In more general terms, according to the Ministry of Housing, some 10 million units are currently needed. This is while the average annual production volume for homes is around 300,000 units. So around 1 million residential units need to be built each year to satisfy this demand. Figures from the Statistics Center of Iran show construction of housing increased by nearly 40% last year. Data from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development show municipalities issue an average of 350,000 residential construction permits each year. Of this amount, roughly 70% lead to construction. However, experts say this is not nearly enough to meet annual housing demands. Last year, the housing construction market saw a slump in completing projects. This was mainly due to the jump in land prices and construction materials that deepened the housing recession. The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development says housing prices have increased by 200% over the last 5 years. This has increased the purchase parity, making some vulnerable groups unable to buy a home.
It might be interesting to know that this issue has gathered the attention of the government for some time now. The government has implemented initiatives to help people purchase homes. One of these initiatives was to increase the amount of bank loans for first home buyers. Several other plans are also underway, such as the vacant house tax plan to increase the amount of available homes.
President Ibrahim Raisi has pledged to build 1 million residential units each year for the next 4 years. This scheme was presented to address and prevent a housing shortage in the country. The Building Contractors Association says planning, execution and building material is available. It emphasized that with large investments and land allocation, this plan can easily go forward. But authorities contend that infrastructure such as electricity and water connectivity requires more planning. Government officials also say wrinkles in the financial model for this project still need to be ironed out. Iran is entirely self-sufficient when it comes to construction material, according to the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. Steel, glass and cement is produced in abundance in the country. In fact, the surplus of these items are exported to several countries around the world. Meanwhile, the light construction industry in Iran is booming amid a long housing recession. New spaces and innovative designs that incorporate the needs of people are being built. Homes are not just a place to live, they are increasingly being seen as a source of capital and a place to increase the quality of living standards. There is also a growing trend towards designing sustainable buildings that reduce emissions and negative environmental impacts. All these achievements make this industry a promising one with a bright future. It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet, despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy. Thank you.
Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested.
Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs.
Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
...2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry.
The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit.
Now it's that time of the show for me to step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague has another awesome field report lined up for you. Take it away.
The basis of the steel industry is iron ore. It's courtesy of this critical raw material that steel is all around us. In the beneficiation process, the gangue minerals, or the mineral matter of no value that occurs with the metallic ore, is removed from the mineral substance and iron ore concentrate is produced. The concentrate is then shipped from mining plants as a bulk commodity by rail.
Hi again. The wagons carrying the iron ore concentrate have reached their destination. What happens at this stage is that through a gargantuan machine, they are overturned. This is called a wagon tippler. What it does is that it tips the wagons. Look, it retains the wagons from the top and it overturns them. First, the wagons are detached from other wagons and then they're lifted over here. And look at those arms. Look at those arms, how gigantic they are. And now they're going to retain the wagon, overturn it to empty its load into a container. From that container, the iron ore concentrate is going to be mixed. First, it's going to travel through some distance and it's going to be mixed with some additives to be fed into the pelletizing process.
In this week's feature program, we visited Chodormalu Industrial Facility located in the center of Iran, Yazd province. The iron ore concentrate must be pelletized for use in iron and steel making. In summary, pelletizing is achieved by combining the iron ore with water and a specific binder, which is then rolled up in a balling drum to produce relatively uniform pellets, which can then be easily handled in downstream processes.
And here we are. The powder is the iron ore concentrate now mixed with some additive. It is now fed into large discs. In this industrial complex, everything is just enormous. This is called the pelleting disc. It's really huge. Now what happens here is through the use of centrifugal force, the powder gets compressed and it's just pushed to the edges of this disc. And after the powder completes a couple rotation and as it grows in size, then it forms the pellets. And once it is just large enough, it will exit the rotation because of that centrifugal force and it moves over to the conveyor belt and it's now time for grading. Now, those particles that are just perfect in size and shape, they will move on to travel over to the kiln where the content moisture is removed and sintering takes place. So the iron pellet now gets hardened and after that, cooling takes place. Now, stay with us for more.
Chodormalu's pelletizing plant, with a production capacity of 3.4 million tons per year, employs 500 people directly and another 3,000 indirectly. The iron ore pellets will be transferred to stackers and are piled in an area which can store 300,000 tons of pellets.
Fe2O3, I don't know how familiar you are with chemistry and the chemical reactions and the periodic table, but anyway, at this stage of the process, Fe2O3 is going to be turned into Fe through a process that is called direct reduction of iron. And this process is done by three main stages. The first stage occurs at a ball furnace. The pellets are poured into the furnace. And what happens inside the furnace is two gases are going to hit the pellets. The gases are carbon monoxide and molecular hydrogen. They're extracted from natural gas through a process that is called reformation. And two gases are going to hit the pellets, and through three chemical reactions, Fe2O3 is going to turn into Fe, which is called the reduced iron, or also sponge iron because of its high porosity. Now, this process can be done in two different ways. One is called hot direct reduction of iron, and the other one is called cold direct reduction of iron. Now, I'm going to move on to the next and the final stage, steel production.
Hot direct reduced iron, or HDRI, is DRI that is transported hot directly from the reduction furnace into an electric arc furnace, thereby saving energy. Whereas cold DRI is the one that is cooled and stored before being charged to a furnace. Well, on the face of it, there's no reason for facilities to even consider cold DRI, but in reality, it's not really that simple. The development of mankind would have been impossible but for steel. It fueled the Industrial Revolution and remains the backbone of modern industrialized economies. The process continues with primary steelmaking, which is done via electric arc furnace at Chodormalu, and then moves on to secondary steelmaking, which involves treating, continuous casting, and shaping.
The final product is made, the steel billet, and you can tell how hot it is in here. Well, the process here starts with the electric arc furnace. It melts the sponge iron that I talked about earlier. And what happens next is that we need some ladles. Ladles are containers. They're going to contain the molten material. Then the ladles are taken over some molds. Molds are going to carry the molten material. And as the molten material is carried over some distance, it solidifies into the final product, which is the steel billet. Now, this complex is really huge. Everything inside it is gigantic. And I've been with you from the very beginning of this process, the iron concentrate, to the very end.
Thanks for that educational adventure once again. Well, that covers our show for today. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In the previous edition of the program, we had a look at the different parts, different phrases of Kumail supplication in details. In this edition, however, we will have a look at the general frame of supplication of Kumail. The supplication of Kumail is among the famous and important prayers among the believers. It is recited on Thursday nights collectively and individually. This supplication belongs to Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, which he taught to Kumail. And thereafter, the believers received it through this channel and passed it on generation after generation. This prayer is rich with such concepts as servanthood and ubudiyyah, repentance and submission, and it is filled with vivid illustrations of petition. There are so many instances of the servant calling for help, of the servants returning to the Almighty Allah. However, we do not intend by these considerations to give a full commentary of this supplication in this edition of the program, since we have already had a look at the different commentary points of this supplication and the idea and the ideas it entails. We will have a look at the general frame of this supplication. This supplication has been particularly arranged in three stages. We can divide this supplication into three stages, such that each stage prepares the ground for the next one. Now, the point is that I assume comprehending this structure, this foundation on which it is based, it helps us a lot in reading other supplications even, in pondering over the concepts and ideas that appear in other supplications as well. Also, it helps us in interacting with the phrases of supplication of Kamal as well as other supplications as well. Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. Oh, zalamtu nafsi, ya Mawlai. Zalamtu nafsi.
واشتد على العزيمة جوانحي واشتد على العزيمة جوانحي.
As I mentioned, this prayer, this supplication of Kamal, consists of three stages. At first stage, we see something like a preamble. The first stage is like a preamble to the supplication. It seems that the first part prepares the supplicant for praying and imploring Allah. The second stage is the one in which Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions the means and wasail by which he seeks refuge and he seeks recourse to Allah. And there are four different means mentioned. And the third stage is the conclusion. Now, in the first stage, which is like a preamble, it prepares the supplicant for praying. The wrongdoings veil a person from Allah and withhold prayer. So, in order for one to stand before his Lord entreating him, he needs first to put behind him this impediment. In this introduction, Imam Ali alayhi salam begins with two requests from the Almighty Allah. The first one is forgiveness from Allah. O Allah, forgive me those sins which... The second request is his remembrance, thankfulness to him and proximity to him. And I beseech you by your generosity to bring me closer to your proximity. Grant me with thankfulness to you and to inspire me with your remembrance. Both of these things are absolutely necessary for the one who intends to stand before Allah to implore him. He has no choice but that Allah should first forgive his sins and remove the veils from his heart, and secondly, allow him to get closer to him. Be grateful to him and inspire him with his remembrance. the second section of the preamble, involves the presentation of poverty, need, and desire toward Allah. Where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Allah, I ask you with the asking of those whose indigence is extreme, who has stated to you in difficulties his need, whose yearning for what is with you has become great. Here, we come across two realities. Firstly, there is no escape from Allah, and Imam Ali alayhi salam is confessing to this fact, saying, O Allah, your power is great, your position is high, your deception is hidden, your command is manifest, and your domination is overwhelming. Secondly, there is no refuge with other than Almighty Allah. O Allah, I find no one to forgive my sins, no one to conceal my wrongdoings, and no one to change my bad deeds into good deeds except you. There is no God but you. La ilaha illa ant. And in the third section of this first stage, which we said is like a preamble, Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions the wretchedness and misfortune of man. O Allah, my tribulation is tremendous. My bad state is excessive. My acts are inadequate. My fetters have tied me down. My far-fetched hopes have held me back from my gain. And this world with its delusions, my soul with its offenses, and my delaying to act have deceived me, O my master. This wretchedness, this misfortune is undoubtedly the outcome of man's deeds. This is why Imam Ali alayhi salam beseeches Allah, the Exalted, to forgive him his sins and not to let them impede his prayer from him. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies.
31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.